Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
And now, the history of the world. Okay, so we've got a problem. Seems that there isn't one. I mean that there isn't one history of the world. Okay, so maybe you already knew this, but let's pretend for a minute that you didn't. I don't want to sound all Twilight Zone-y or like a sci-fi nerd, but there exist parallel histories. Not unlike parallel universes, these histories run right alongside our own and have gone on relatively unnoticed. They've received little or no mention in textbooks and have remained nearly invisible. People in the West have generally shared a common narrative of world history, one that runs from the Nile Valley in Mesopotamia through Greece and Rome to the rise of the secular state and the triumph of democracy. But this story largely omits a certain civilization, an entire civilization, a massive one at that, one that has existed, grown, and developed, not on another planet or universe, but one that has existed right next door and adjacent to our own for over 1,000 years, one that until recently considered itself at the center of world history. Why did two great civilizations grow up almost totally oblivious to each other? What happens when they intersect, and how has the Islamic world been affected by its slow recognition that Europe, a place long perceived by Muslims as primitive and disorganized, has somehow managed to hijack destiny? Tamim Amsari provides us with answers to some of these questions in his new book, Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. Tamim Amsari grew up in Kabul. Upon receiving a scholarship in the mid-60s, he moved to the U.S. to attend high school in Colorado. 6 years later, he graduated from Reed College with honors, then plunged himself into the counterculture of the late 60s, publishing an alternative weekly, living on a commune, writing obscure experimental fiction, working odd jobs, and traveling as much as possible, all the while never forgetting his Afghani roots. He is a regular columnist for Microsoft's learning site Encarta.com and the author of nonfiction books for children, Jokes for a Mathematics Program, a literary memoir, West of Kabul, East of New York, several novels for reluctant readers, a series of educational comic books, countless letters to friends, and one two-line play. His commentary has been heard on The Bill Moyers Show, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, The Oprah Winfrey Show, Hardball, and numerous national public radio stations. He currently lives in San Francisco, where he is director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. In conversation this evening with Tamim is Amir Hussein, professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University. Amir teaches courses on Islam and world religions. A fellow of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities, he was selected by student vote as LMU's Professor of the Year in 2008. His most recent book, Oil and Water, Two Faiths, One God, An Introduction to Islam for a North American Audience, is on sale this evening in the lobby. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in turning off or silencing our cell phones, pagers, and other noisemakers, and in welcoming Tamim Amsari and Amir Hussein to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Hello, you all. Nice to see you here.
Good evening. It's a pleasure for me to be here today with Tamim Amsari, and especially the fact that this program is co-presented with the Center for Global Understanding, an organization founded to try and create better understanding within the Muslim world and between Muslims and non-Muslims, which is what I think Tamim does in the book. I teach, as Justin very kindly said, at Loyola Marymount University, and one of my colleagues is a wonderful professor of English, and someone asked him once, you know, what do you do in the universities? And he says, it's very simple. In the university, we tell stories. We call the old stories teaching. We call the new stories research. Yeah. And I love that. And I start with that story because this, for me, is the real gift of Tamim's book, Destiny Disrupted. He's not a historian. He's not an academic. He's a storyteller. And he's a darn good storyteller. And the story that he tells is our story. Tamim, I don't know if you want to start talking a little bit about some of that story that you tell, or those stories in the book.
Well, I guess since you're asking me to introduce the book, I'll say this. Maybe some of you saw that New Yorker cover that says, here's a map of America seen from downtown Manhattan, and half of it gets you to 52nd Street, and half the distance splitting again gets you to Washington Heights, and then there's a little sliver of Kansas and barely California in the distance. So my book is subtitled, what is it subtitled?
History of the World Through Islamic Eyes.
History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. And that was my idea, that if you are situated someplace between Istanbul and the Indus River and you look around and you say, what's the world? You are actually living in a world that's universal and global in the sense that it has many societies interacting. They're not the same. It has a story of its own. These people are all mixed up in one another's stories. And that's the story you see. And then on beyond that, much more, you know, occupying less and less space as you get to something like the West. That's the rest of the story, and it's very small there, until that part of the world comes into your story, and that has happened for the Muslim world, and that's the story I tell. Some of the places where I've talked about this book, people have said, you know, this book wasn't what we expected, and I'm going to tell you guys that right now, in case you expect this. In fact, someone called me from North Carolina and said, I picked up your book, I read it, and it wasn't what I thought. And I didn't know him from Adam. Anyway, but I was happy to hear from a reader. Anyway, and what he said was, and several others have said, we thought this was going to be a history of what the Muslim world thinks of us. And, you know, that's like the narcissist who spends an hour talking about himself and then says, oh, that's enough about me. What do you think of me? You know, the truth is, the Muslim world has a history of its own, and in a large part of that, it wasn't really thinking about us. So that's the story I'm telling.
Tell me a little bit about the title, because that would be my first question for you. That the title is Destiny Disrupted. Whose destiny and what disrupts it?
Okay, well, first of all, I will say this. It took almost as long to write that five-word title as the rest of the book. So I had many, many titles. But there was always some idea of wanting to nail down the essence of the story I'm telling by capturing this idea that here is this world that has a historical momentum. And that's what I think we ended up trying to represent with the word destiny. Now, destiny might not be quite the right word, but you know, in any context, you have a sense of where history is going and where it will somehow end up if it, you know, if things go along as they are and if it all works out. And I think we have that sense here in the United States and in the West that we're on the cutting edge. Some other countries are maybe not as developed. They're coming over to being like us, and the future is somewhere further along the path that we're on. So the Muslim world had that sort of historical story-like sense of itself, a sense of momentum, a sense of destination, which is mixed up in the word destiny. And then its story is that at a certain point, Muslims looked around and said, wait a minute, Our society is permeated by these people who aren't on the same agenda, and we're not masters of our own house somehow, and we're not in charge of our own destiny. What happened? What happened to the course of history? And that activated a whole lot of thinking, and certain movements sprang up in the Muslim world as a response to that. And then we are still living with the consequences of those movements that started up, say, over the last 300 to 100 years ago.
As an academic, I'm always interested in context. Tell us a little bit more about your own personal story. You know, how does a nice boy from Kabul end up in the wilds of Los Angeles and before that in Reed College and doing all these kinds of
interesting
things?
Not that nice, actually. Well, you know, my father was one of the first few batches of Afghan students who were sent abroad to study. And there were two before him, and then it was interrupted, and then he was sent. And he was the first to marry an American woman and bring her back to the country, and she came back and lived in Afghanistan for something over 20 years. So, you know, I grew up from earliest childhood with a foot in two worlds. I was partly American, partly Afghan. And throughout my time in Afghanistan, that was the case there, too. There were Americans started to come over, and I was part of their community. When I went home, I was part of my Afghan community. When I came here, I still somehow faced or had to grapple with this sense of divided identity. And in the long run, I feel like what it gave me was a sense of relativity about how things are. It's even encapsulated in language. You know, it's when I speak English, I feel like one guy, and when I switch over and speak Farsi, I kind of feel like another guy. And the truth is, I'm just going to talk about language for a moment. The thing you understand if you really grow up in two languages is that languages aren't a set of words that map onto each other. When you translate from one language to another, you don't just take from here and substitute everything from here. It doesn't come out the same. Languages are networks of meaning that are connected to social worlds. So there are these two frameworks, not just two, of course, but two that I knew. And in the last decade, nearly a decade, when we've had a world in turmoil and we can look back and say, man, a lot of chaos and misery and ruin, it has felt that to me as though my curse of having this divided identity and struggling with that is actually, you know, in a sense, it's an obligation and a blessing, and I have to do something with that position of being able to see on both sides of a fence I'm sitting on. So that's why I wrote my memoir, West of Kabul, East of New York. That was the point there. And then this is, you know, this is sort of pursuing the same agenda, looking at trying to give a view that's holistic about the other side.
And I think it really requires someone like you who's steeped in both sides, because it's very easy, and we were talking this earlier, to do polemical kinds of things. You know, as I mentioned, I teach at Loyola Marymount. It's very easy for my students to go out there and sort of prove the truth of their hypothesis without bothering to read any of the 10 books that contradict their hypothesis. You know, they've got their thesis and they go out there and prove it. That's great. That's also very simple and very easy to do. And that's what I love about this book is that there isn't that thesis of you're not saying, you know, the history of the Islamic world is better than the history of the Western world, or the history of the Western world is better. And there's a sympathy, I think, to both of those histories here that really comes through in the book.
You know, a lot of things that I think about, the way that I end up thinking about them is that if you look at what the circumstances are that the people are dealing with who get into these positions, it's hard to really approach it with a casting blame attitude. And I think that about current events, too. Not to say that there are not forces and people in the world of whom I am highly critical, but some of the things that have gone wrong, I can see how it happened, you know. And I feel like the way to deal with it is to figure out that mechanism of how it happened, and then you're better able to undo those circumstances, hopefully.
It's funny because when I started reading your book, I knew right from the beginning that I'd love the book, and part of that has to do with connections and mentors that you mention in your acknowledgments, a book written in 1957 by a man named Wilfred Cantwell Smith called Islam in Modern History. And Wilfred at that time taught at McGill University, moved to Harvard, directed the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard for 20 years, and then retired to Toronto, which is a city that I grew up in. And so I had the great privilege of working with Wilfred towards the end of his life. And he's one of those kinds of people, that this is a Canadian, educated sort of at the best schools, who in 1940 decides, I want to learn about Islam. And he does something radical, because in 1940s in academia, learning about Islam is reading Arabic texts. Maybe Persian texts, if you're really, you know, on the fringe, a Turkish text that most Muslims have never even heard of, let alone read. And Wilfred says, no, I want to go live with Muslims. And in 1940, before the partition of India and Indian Pakistan, India is the country with the most Muslims. So he goes and lives for 6 years in Lahore. And when Wilfred and I met, that was the first sort of conversation, that here's this Canadian academic who's lived in Lahore, the city that I was born in, longer than I lived in that city before I moved to Toronto. And you know, my parents were working class, and so my Urdu was definitely of the gutter snipe variety. Wilfred's was of the very high Lucknow, the proper accent kind of thing. But it takes a person like that who's deeply, deeply sympathetic to both of those cultures, which is the kind of person that you are.
Thank you.
In the book, you talk about a number of things, and one of the things I want to raise is, for example, the Sunni-Shia issue. And the book really isn't about Islam qua religion. I mean, there's an introductory section that talks about Islam and talks about the Prophet and basic sorts of practices, but it's really more about the history and the politics. But I think the religion clearly is important. And when you talk, for example, about the Sunni-Shia split, which is something that's in the news today because, of course, of what's happening in Iraq. You know, we hear about Shias because of what's happening in Iran. And you write about this in such an incredibly powerful way, in a way that for me as a Sunni Muslim, who certainly understands things about the Shia tradition, but coming from a Sunni side, that's, you know, where I was born and grew up in, the sympathy here is so powerful. And the words you write, for example, about Ali, you know, the first imam for the Shias, the fourth successor of the Prophet Muhammad, you know, important both for Sunnis and Shias, and yet sort of more important within the Shia tradition, you know, the notion of the family there, which I think is really quite powerful.
You know, I want to mention here, Amir wrote a book called Oil and Water, and I read some of that on Google, and I've ordered the book, incidentally, so... And don't you guys just read this on Google. But you know, there's parts of that book where you speak about Prophet Muhammad with an affection, and you mention that with an affection that's like the affection you would have for someone you personally know. That's just a good guy, you know. And I feel like that's so much a part of the Muslim experience that I really think is not very well known outside the tradition. The fact that Muhammad himself and then these four successors, and for people who are more deeply into it, others of these companions that, you know, that most of us don't really know their names or personalities, they are living human beings who went through a tremendous drama. And the core of the drama was surely something that to the people who lived through it felt as apocalyptically important as anything could happen, could be, and they were in it and they were having the experience. And so this Sunni-Shia thing, you know, the origins of it is, the origins of it are, that at the moment that Prophet Muhammad died, there was a conundrum about what to do now in terms of a successor. You know, it isn't obvious at all that if a prophet dies or a sage or a powerfully wise person, that a successor is immediately needed. You know, you don't need a successor. In fact, the thing that you have in mind is there'll never be another one of these. And yet, at that moment, the Muslim community was a political community. When the head of a political community dies, there's no question that you need a successor. You got to have one, or the community will fall apart. And what's more, the evolution of Islam up to that point made it clear to the people who were living through it that this community was part of the sacred experience. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that a preacher came and said some things about how you should conduct your life. It was that this powerful personality came and established a community, and the community was to be somehow the living embodiment of this idea. So now, definitely you need a successor. But what is that successor going to be? The prophet has died. The prophet has said in his last sermon, there will never be another messenger of God, Peygamber. So the successor is not going to be that. But what is the successor going to be? Now, you can see that there is deep theological issues wrapped up in what decision the community makes. And at that moment, there was one person who to some seemed like the obvious successor, and he was the prophet's son-in-law, Ali, who was also, in a sense, the prophet's brother, since they grew up in the same household. The uncle took in the orphan Muhammad. He was a much older brother, which in that context makes him almost like a father. So, it's like in so many ways, Ali was close to the flesh and blood of Muhammad. Muhammad had no son. He only had daughters who survived. And that one daughter was married to Ali, and the children of that marriage would be the prophet's grandchildren. So for some people, it's like, yeah, that's the guy. But then there's this other idea, which is the message is the whole thing. Now we're not going to look for somebody who is the flesh of blood of Muhammad, inspired with grace and has some special power. So some of the community said there was that they should elect the person that had the most respect in the community, probably an elder. So that was the doctrinal division, and that was also, a real-life community sort of emotional event. And then in the next 30 years or so, a lot happened in that community, and it ended up with some things that were terrible. There was a huge battle, and people got killed. And it wasn't a battle over money or greed or pride, or it was really people felt this was so important. You can't let this experience, this event, go wrong. And yet, it landed up in these tremendously traumatic emotional experiences. You can see why there was a division in the community, and why there was so much emotion involved in it. And the other thing I want to say about that is now, all these years later, when you hear that there's clashes between Shias and Sunnis, it isn't about doctrine. And there is so little that you can point your finger to and say, this is how Shias do their rituals differently. They put their hand here instead of here. That's not what they're fighting about. They're fighting because something happened in the recent past that still has left bad feelings. And that happened because there was something in that recent past that still left bad feelings. It's historical continuity, of grievance and pain. And you don't get rid of that until you somehow deal with the grievance. And then also there's mixed up in that is material problems, and you have to deal with those. So,
and that historical context is so important. You sort of start telling the story at the beginning of the book that you come to write this book really through textbooks and your experience of textbooks. How is this history taught in world history textbooks? Yeah. And if you want to talk a little bit about that, because I found that fascinating.
Well, textbook publishing is a fascinating thing in this country. And I was in it for many, many years. And, very rarely in textbook publishing do you get to start over. The general thing, not so much in college textbooks, but in kindergarten, 12th grade, K-12 as they call it, in that market, you always start with the thing that was already there. And as an editor, you compare it to all the other things that are already there. and you see who has something you don't have, and you say, okay, I'm going to have that too so that we can't be all outsold. And then you see what all the states say they want, and you put that in, and you see, and you put that in. So you get this sort of mushy gravy of indistinct curriculum. In the year 2000, there was a startup textbook publishing company that didn't have a textbook already, and they hired me to help them put out something that would compete with the world history textbook market. Well, a development editor in that context does not just get to do what he wants. You have to consult with your advisors, you know, curriculum specialists, high school teachers, scholars, salespeople, blah, 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 which is, I think, you know, I want to say that's not a bad thing, because you don't want textbooks to be some wacko's crazy idea, you know. And if it was just up to me, probably it would turn out that way. There's the proof. But you know, you have this process that more or less ensures that you're going to end up with something that is the social consensus of opinion about what's true. So I'm saying all that in order to lead up to our conversations. I started to realize skewed in a certain way that wasn't how I saw it, you know. And the way that it was, the thing that was that was a difference between me and the rest of the crowd, was that it seemed to me that Islam was more important than we were tending to say.
This is in the year 2000. This is pre-9/11.
This is in the year 2000, and our project went into the year 2001. So this is like in the shadow of 9/11. And, you know, one issue after another would come up, and I'd say, well, we should probably have a chapter on that. And then people would say, a whole chapter? You know, we've got 10 units, three chapters in each unit, so we've only got 30 chapters now. I don't know if we can do a whole chapter for that. How about if we do sidebar, you know, in someplace? And so it went like that, I wasn't prepared to say, oh, I'm right, you know, because I didn't feel that way. I felt like, well, you know, we're in conversation, and the truth is what comes out of our conversation. Well, what we ended up with was one chapter out of 30 was specifically devoted to Islam, and it was part of a unit that the other chapters were pre-Columbian civilizations of the Americas and ancient empires of Africa. So, and so that chapter was about the founding of Islam and Islam's position in medieval times as a powerful empire. Well, what that indicated was that our consensus seemed to be that whatever this thing was, it ended long ago. And, you know, I'm looking at over there, east of us, and I'm saying, how are we failing to notice this, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like there's a big thing over here. But I think it's because talking about the group think about this. We weren't thinking about that as all one thing. We were thinking about it as countries, and some were in the Soviet sphere of influence and some weren't. And, you know, so we chopped it up differently, and we didn't see a coherence to the whole entity. And while I wasn't prepared to, I hadn't thought it out clearly at the time, but later as I started to think about it, it came to me that, you know, when you're over there, you look at this entity, and it has a continuity through history, and it goes all the way back. And the more I looked at it, the more I got this sort of eerie sense that, you know, this is like a whole shadow alternative history, and it has some strange parallels to Western history as we know it. You know, just the fact that, I'll just mention one of them, the fact that, you know, you stand in the present moment and look back and you see a universal founding empire. It's Rome. Well, not if you're over there. It's the Caliphate over there. And then that empire got so big it couldn't hold together with the technology of the time. It started to fragment into separate parts. That's happened to Rome, happened to the Caliphate. Then the barbarians from the north came down. It was the Germans in Rome. It was the Turks in the other empire. And you can go through and see parallel after parallel And it's like, wow, another whole history. And then, however, they stop being parallel. And that's because they intersect. And then things become a whole new story. So
and it's the same thing with maps. That you have wonderful maps here, but you always talk about, well, where's the center of the world? Yeah. Well, it depends. Yeah.
Yeah. There is no real center of the world, you know, of course. That's
well, Los Angeles, but that's...
I think it's San Francisco, but anyway.
I love coming to the LA Public Library, and I think it was probably the third or fourth time that I was here that I noticed on the Flower Street entrance, I don't know how many of you saw that, you know, the philosophers, and have paid attention to how that's divided, because it's the thinkers of the East, Buddha, Lao Tzu, Muhammad, Al-Ghazali, Avicenna, and then the thinkers of the West, and it's the Greek tradition, you know, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. It goes through Descartes, Bacon, and we were talking about this earlier, that Avicenna, Ibn Sina, who you write about in the book, belongs much more alongside Aristotle and Plato than he does with Buddha and Lao Tzu. But we you know, bifurcate the world into the East and the West, and it's really fascinating because one of the things I love about the book is it shows the connections. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aristotle in the Middle Ages was the philosopher. Because Al-Farabi, a Muslim, was the commentator on the philosopher.
Yeah.
And you point out how so many things, and this is something I think, you know, Muslims will talk about, I think, with no small amount of pride around the issue of, you know, the intellectual achievements mm-hmm. of the Muslim world that really set the stage yeah. for the European Renaissance.
And, you know, there was that whole period in the during the era of the United Caliphate when... in the Muslim world, some of the thinkers were known as philosophers. There wasn't the word science at that time. Philosophy was some philosophers were doing work that would later become science. And for those guys, actually, philosophy was not separate from religion. They didn't think of themselves as being in a separate field of inquiry. They were trying to figure out what is the ultimate truth. But they came up with so much stuff that was on the verge of being modern science. And yet somehow the scientific revolution didn't happen there. And that, I think, is a really interesting question to look at and see why didn't it happen there.
Did you want to talk a little bit, because you mentioned that in the book.
Yeah. I was going to go off into, because of my head thought about something else, sure. which was Farabi was the commentator on Aristotle, but I think it's so cool that Ghazali was the guy whose work on Aristotle is how Aristotle got into Europe. And what's really amusing in a way is that he set to work, his agenda was he was going to disprove Aristotle, or he was going to refute Aristotle. He was going to refute the whole school that he called the philosophers, who were tending towards a rationalist explanation or approach to religion. And in order to do that, to do a fair-minded job of that, he was going to first explain what Aristotle said. And so he wrote a book that was an explanation of what Aristotle said, and it was so wonderfully articulate and clear that many people who studied Aristotle all their lives said, wow, okay, finally I understand Aristotle. I haven't seen that book, but apparently he wrote an introduction, explaining what his idea was, and that he was, after this book, he was going to write another book called The Refutation of the Philosophers right. or something like that.
Yeah, the Hafidus Lassa.
Yeah, and so he was going to refute all this in the next book, but this book, that prologue dropped away somehow when it came into Europe. So that many Europeans thought this was actually the work of Aristotle, so in translation. And then that ended up being, one of the main ways that interest in Aristotle revived in Europe. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But, you know, the other question you asked you posed science. About why didn't science take off? The explanation I give in my book, and it's my speculation, I just feel that the sort of the peak achievements of the philosophers in the Muslim world came right about the time that socially that world was breaking down. The Turks were coming in, there was fragmentation, there was anxiety every place, and there was a what happens in cases of turmoil and universal anxiety, there is a turning away from nuance and subtlety and intellectual parsing, because people want to have more secure and absolute answers to things. So I feel that when you compare that to the West, where it's embarking on the ideas of science, came at the beginning of the period when the West was socially really getting itself together. So those two things coincided, and therefore the West ran with it. More generally, though, it seems to me, and I look at technology and other things, it's just, the social underlay for ideas is really the most crucial thing. It'll take off if there's an interaction between a set of ideas and what the society is looking for and wants, and if that match is not there, then things die on the vine. So.
And that, in a funny way, connects us to the other thing that I wanted to raise, which goes back to Aristotle, that, these days, of course, we're all watching what's happening in Iran, with the protests there, with the election, with what's happening. And people throw around this phrase, clash of civilizations. And what I like about the book is you don't really use that phrase. And one of my great heroes is Roy Mutahida, who's a professor at Harvard, wonderful, wonderful scholar of Iran. And his book, The Mantle of the Prophet, is a phenomenal book looking at what happens in Iran. And he starts writing this book talking about the Shia clerics in Qom. Qom is the city in Iran that, is famous for training these clerics. And they're reading Aristotle. And I'm looking at this going, well, what does that mean? Because my students at LMU, as wonderful as they are, aren't reading Aristotle. The Iranian mullahs are reading Aristotle. And so, this sense of a clash of civilizations that doesn't really work. And you use the phrase, and I wrote it down from the book, mismatched histories, which I love. And I don't mean to embarrass you by reading something from your book, but let me embarrass you by reading
something. I hope it's not an embarrassment.
No. It's a wonderful thing. It's I'm sure it's odd for you as an author to have someone else read your words, especially out loud to you. And the conflict racking the modern world is not, I think, best understood as a class of civilizations, if that proposition means we're different, so we must fight till there's only one of us. It's better understood as the friction generated by two mismatched world histories intersecting. Muslims were a crowd of people going somewhere. Europeans and their offshoots were a crowd of people going somewhere. When the two crowds crossed paths, much bumping and crashing resulted, and the crashing is still going on. I love that, and I wonder if you talk a little bit more about that sense of these mismatched histories and learning about each other's histories, because I think my sort of naive understanding is that for people in the Muslim Americans, people in the Muslim world, we sort of know our history a little bit, but certainly better than Westerners know Islamic history. Mm-hmm. We were taught. I grew up in the Canadian school system, so for me, the history of the world was a history of Britain and France, and that was it. We never learned about Portugal and Spain in the same way that we learned about Britain and France. And so I think here we learn that history, and many of us are products of a colonial system where that was the state history that you were taught in the state schools.
Yeah, the dominant civilization is more known by the other groups of people than the other way, so to speak. So Western history is known by everybody. I think that is true. But I want to go back for a moment to this clash of civilizations thing. Although I want to set it aside, I think it's the word clash is the problem here. The flip side of that is that I feel that people have taken from the refutation of clash of civilizations the denial that there are civilizations. Although you're right that there's no clear borders, there's no anything like that, but there is entity-like status to civilizations. And the reason I say this is because I feel that often when people reject that civilizational way of talking about things and in favor of saying, oh, we're all just people, unknowingly, they're saying, we're all just people and we're all just like me. Mm-hmm. And that's what's not true. Mm-hmm. We are people, but we are also our cultural detritus, our worldviews. There's a lot of peopleness is not just an organic biological thing. And if you get to that too easily, you fail to make that leap and get into the other person's head. And that's what I think we need to do always, both sides. You know? Absolutely. Both sides. But
And that's something I can talk to my students about as a Canadian, using that Canadian-American example, that, you know, we as Canadians have no idea who we are as a people. You know, huge country, small population, but huge country, all sorts of issues. What unites us is that we know we're not Americans, which is a very weird way of, you know, self-existing. And we learn American history. You know, grade 7, went to Gettysburg, went to D.C., learned American history, you know, because America isn't just the most important country in the world because of military or economics, it's its culture.
Yeah.
You know, you get American television all over the world. You don't get, you know, Canadian television or French television here unless you subscribe to specialty channels. But it really is that sense of the minority having to know the dominant history. And so what do you do when you're part of different cultures and different histories?
You know, you mentioned that you get American TV all over the world, and I'm thinking about, I was in Pakistan, you know, in 2003, I think it was, and I was in the airport there, and there was a TV, and there was some show, and the show was, maybe it was VH1 or MTV or something like that, and there was some, you know, hard rock, gothic death symbolism band playing. And there was a family of Pakistanis sitting there. The women were there, too. They had their chaudars, you know. They were older women. And they were just, like, looking at this.
The decline of Western civilization.
Man, you know, this is not coming across the way those guys thought it was.
Sure. Or the grandmothers here who say exactly the same thing, watching exactly the same things there. You end the book really sort of at about 9/11, and then there's an afterword that talks about, you know, the things that have happened in the years since then. But I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about an issue that I'm sure is on many people's minds as someone who is an Afghan, you know, about what's happening in Afghanistan and where you see things, you know, because of the war and other things that are happening there.
Well, you know, I am really concerned about what's happening in Afghanistan because it looks like, I feel like ever since 9/11, I've known that this was going to happen if we keep going this way, and it did happen, and it's like a terrible thing to be prescient in this regard. There was an abandonment of Afghanistan in terms of reconstruction by the United States very shortly after the Taliban were ousted. And I was, I had this famous email that I talked about the dangers of military intervention in Afghanistan, but I was not against the ouster of the Taliban in the way that it was initially done. If there had been at that point, a follow-up of a certain kind of reconstruction. And that didn't happen, and it wasn't just that money didn't pour into the country, because after a while, money did pour into the country. But the money that poured in was big projects with billions of dollars allocated for them, three-quarters of which were spent here before it ever went over there. And then when it goes over there, it's an expert engineer making $200,000 a year, protected by a bodyguard making $200,000 a year, with a translator making $150,000 a year, all of them riding in an armored vehicle that costs $100,000. So, you know, that unit accounts for $500,000 or something, and they're overseeing a project where Afghans are working for $10 a week breaking rocks to build a road, a road they didn't ask for. That's not to say the road is not a good thing, but they didn't ask for it, so it's just like it just came. But on top of that, even this money that came in this very kind of like undistributed way caused a a tremendous amount of inflation in the places where it was happening without any corresponding economic change that would give people any way to keep up with that inflation. So like in Kabul, rents go up by 40 times while policemen are still making $50 a month. Obviously, the policeman is going to be engaged in getting a little money wherever he can. I was told by my one of my relatives when I was there, I saw four car accidents in Kabul in the course of 3 weeks, two of them with fatalities, and that's just what I saw in front of me. So it was like a chaotic thing. I said, "What happens? I didn't stay. What happened? What when there's an accident like that?" So the guy said, "Oh, you know, the police come." I said, "What do the police do?" He says, "They collect from everybody." I said, they have to make a living too." So then this kind of pervasive thing ends up being called in the media corruption, but it isn't exactly corruption. You know, it's like the inevitable product of the underlying mechanisms in place. At the same time, you know, this is what I had in mind when I was saying I'm not in the business of talking in terms of blame, because I think about myself, and if I were going to go over there to do some job, it's dangerous over there. And, you know, I'm not going to go over there unless I get a pretty good, hefty, you know, unless there's something in it for me. And then, you know, the armored vehicle and all that, it's just, those are all made inevitable by the way the situation is set up. The military bases over there, they are like these entirely separate things from the surrounding land. Afghans work in those. They know that people are, you know, eating steak and having what, from the local perspective, is this tremendous lifestyle. So there's a lot of money coming in. All the food is shipped in from Australia. They don't buy from the surrounding countryside. They don't buy mutton. They don't buy vegetables. They don't because it's considered a security risk. So there is an explanation for it. But the end of the process is there's just this military base sitting with no connection to the people. So these things continue to generate what had been an aid program is turning into what feels to people like an occupation. And the new military guys are trying to fix that and do something different, but I don't know how they can turn it around exactly. You know, so I'm pessimistic about that part.
and the role of our own involvement there, which again you detail in the book, that, you know, I think only Robert Scheer sort of remembers this, that pre 9/11 in the beginning months of 2001, you know, our government gave $43 million to the Taliban. And this was in 2001 when we knew about human rights, when we knew about treatment of women, we knew about treatment of minorities, because of course before the war on terror, it was the war on drugs. And they declared growing opium un-Islamic, and therefore we gave them the money. And you think, like, what do you think they did with this money? What do you think the Saudis are doing with the weapons that we give them? What do you think Egypt is doing with the money and the weapons that we give them? And I think that's one of the really the powerful things in the book that shows those connections of what are those connections between, let's say, America and parts of the Muslim world, and certainly not having that same colonial experience that the British and the French have had, but those connections, that interweaving of histories.
Well, you know, don't get me started on the interweaving between gun trade, drugs, Islamism, terrorism. And, you know, they're so mixed together that it's really hard to unravel that stuff. But I think with the you know, the Islamist jihadist ideology that's in play in the world in these situations, what I want to try to bring across is, and you know, I'm far from the only guy that says this, but Islam is this big thing, and that's not Islam. That's not to say that it doesn't have some, it doesn't derive from Islam. It has roots in Islam. So it isn't right also to just say, oh, that's just a few crazies. They got their ideology from someplace.
Absolutely.
And I feel like some of the work that is to be done is doctrinal work. And, you know, here's something I want to toss out there. My brother is an Islamic scholar of the most conservative stripe. And he came to see me last August, and I was writing this book. I had finished the first draft. So I said, would you read my book? He said, sure. So I gave him the book, and he said, I'm writing my master's thesis. Would you read that? And I said, well, sure. And so he read my book, which is written so that anyone can read it, and that was great, and he gave me a lot of good feedback. And then it was my task to read his master's thesis, which is densely footnoted, academic, Islamic scholarship. Just, you know, it was difficult. It was a difficult read.
By which you mean a marvelous, exciting...
Well... You know, I had thought that I was going to be able to give him some pointers on writing and stuff, but it was like, for what it was written so well, there was nothing for me to say. And it wasn't until, and so I wrote a response to him, but my response ended up being my own thesis about where I disagreed with some of his premises. But later when I thought about what he was doing here, I realized this is a really important thesis, doctrinally. And the subject of his thesis is the argument that consequences of actions must be taken into account when you're determining whether you're applying the Sharia correctly. And, you know, that's where you can get the beginning of... an escape from the literalism that might be one of the traps that people fall into in this doctrinal situation. What he's saying is you can't just take the literal word and apply it and then say, well, you know, whatever happens. That was the word of God. But a person like me could never write that, and it would not be effective because I come from outside that premise to such a degree that part of what I'd be saying was I question these premises. You need it from a guy like him whose argument is completely based on scripture and original first 100 years texts. So I think we need a lot more of that.
Let me just ask you one more question before we open it up to the audience, because I know people here have wonderful questions to ask. And that's really... just to conclude, to talk about Afghans in America and maybe talk a little bit about the Afghani community here and some of the issues, some of the things that you see.
Well, you know, Afghans in America almost all came after 79-80, because that's when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and there was a catastrophe. So the community here is the, you know, they ran away from the catastrophe. Over the last couple of years, I did a project where I was hoping to encourage young Afghan-Americans to write about their experiences. And in the process, I met a lot of young Afghan-Americans. And I really became aware that they're having they're going through an experience that is powerful and very worth recording and exploring. And an experience that is unknown to themselves and others. Because they are growing up in the shadow of their parents' dramatic story. Their parents had the story where they dropped everything, picked up what they could carry under both arms, and just ran and lost half of themselves on the way, and you know the horror of it. Whereas the generation that now is growing up in America, you know, they had conflicts in high school. It must feel like big deal. But in fact, to grow up looking for your identity in a time when you know in a context where you have some trouble fitting in to the American high school experience and America in general, and so you're cast back on yourself and you say, well, who am I? What is my identity? And you want to go back to your roots and say, okay, well, I'm an Afghan. And so now you're looking for your identity in a place you either barely remember or you never have seen, and you're claiming your identity in perhaps Islam, which is in the last 8 years something that you can feel the disapproval of the society of who you say you want to be. That's a really difficult problem of identity. And, you know, I have my own life story of struggle with conflicting cultures, but I was in D.C., large group, talking to them in connection with this book, and I just sort of offhandedly, something came up about this divided thing, and I just offhandedly said, you know, it isn't all a blessing. It's not all a good thing. Actually, there's a lot of pain involved in it and struggle and so on. I didn't say anything very dramatic, and I look in the front seats, and I see that there's obviously a young Afghan woman, and she's crying. And I went, oh, I wonder what her experience is, because that obviously resonated. So that's, you know, so now there's this whole generation that's looking for themselves here in America. And I think it's going to work out, though.
Thank you for that, Tamim. And at this point, let me open it up, and we've got Justin and Libby with microphones. So if you've got a question, please raise your hand, and the mics will find you. There's a couple of people at the back. Yeah, straight at the back.
Mine is a two-part question. What would you forecast as the outcome of the Afghanistan war and also the outcome of the presidential elections in Iran, and what do you think the eventuality will become after their end?
Well, let me take the second one first. He said, for those of you who didn't hear it, what's the eventual outcome of the Afghan war and what is going to happen in Iran? Well, I'll say briefly about the Afghan war. I just really don't know. It's gone out of control, I would say, so I can't predict. The Iran crisis is very... I guess my own feeling is that the regime there is in serious trouble. And it's in serious trouble because it is the division in Iran runs vertically. It's not just a case of the people rising up against a united and homogenous tyranny. There is important insider clerics on one side and important highly placed clerics on the other side, and that regime has boxed itself into a place where it obviously committed fraud. And that fraud is not necessarily in the election itself. I was looking at many polls, like the Guardian poll before the election, that said the results were not that different from what the regime put out. But that no longer matters, because they put out results before they counted the votes, and there's no question about that. And so... you know, so what that does is it takes the question of fraud out of the ballot box, out of the trucks rolling down the streets, and puts it squarely in general headquarters of the supreme leader. So now you can see that he's saying, "Oh, we'll look into the fraud. We'll look into the fraud," because he doesn't want to have the focus be on his office and what it may have done. But the problem is, you know, he's arguing with people who are also parts of the Islamic Revolution. Now that he has called out riot police, it's the regime turning the guns on itself, and in order to justify that, they are obliged to say these guys are loyal to United States and they're spying for the other side. But that, even if it succeeds, discredits the regime, because they're saying that about people who were highly placed, you know, they were like intimate companions of Khomeini himself. So they're really in trouble, and I think they're getting into worse trouble with all of that. At the same time, it's important to look at, you know, Mousavi, his statement that he put out on Facebook that some of you may have read. It's full of, we're here to save the revolution. You know, he's not presenting himself as, all right, we're done with Islam, let's go back to that way we used to be when we were a client state of the United States. That would be good. and I still feel that it's really crucial for the United States to have a completely hands-off, neutral stance on this thing. Of course, because something like John McCain's statement that America should lead the Iranian Revolution, just feeds into, you know, that's what the embattled core regime would want. But it's not just because of that. It's also because there was a lot more going on in the Islamic Revolution of Iran than just Islam. There was a nationalist element to that, and there was also the secular modernist constitutionalist movement, which was crushed by Khomeini in cooperation with, or he sort of expropriated the nationalist passion. And in the outcome here, if the reformists actually do end up winning this thing, they still have a problem of establishing their credentials and credibility with many, you know, with a large part of Iran. So they will need not to have their victory tainted by U.S. aid, because if it is, they will be in a position where they can't deal with the U.S. in a they'll have to be more hardline. You know, we, by staying out of it, we will enable them to be dealing with us better if they win. And if they don't, well, I think you know, if it's not tomorrow, it's later. The regime is now in trouble. So,
thank you. There's another question at the back.
Thank you. I had two questions. One was the, you talked about the split between Shia and Sunni. Which one, which group was Muhammad's relatives?
Well, you know, to some extent, they were all kind of related. It depends on how close you mean. And it's the Shias that are the close relative. Ali was the close relative of Muhammad, and Shia means partisan, you know. So his party, he was like he had followers, and they were called the partisans of Ali. So,
thank you. The other question I have is, I've been told that Kandahar is a butchery of Alexander's name, that it's Alexander the Great that came through bringing Greek culture throughout the and the Persian culture throughout the Middle East, and that culminated with the Middle East exporting their culture into Spain and Andalusia. Is that true, or is that fantasy reading? From
I didn't hear about the Andalusian part. I don't think there's any connection between Alexander and Andalusia. But Alexander is known as Iskandar in the Persian world, and so Kandahar is really just Kandar. You know, they dropped the Is. And so it was a city founded by him, allegedly.
Gentlemen, here at the hat. There's, the microphone's right behind you.
Isn't there a problem with the political leaders in much of the Islamic world? And can you comment on that? Has political leadership failed to evolve for some reason in the Islamic world, as it may have evolved elsewhere, perhaps in the West?
There is a problem. You know, this is there's a good analysis of this problem. It's this book right here. And
available for sale in a few minutes.
There is a problem. I think it's all wrapped up with those reform movements that I talked about, and the fact that for a while, the dominant one was a tendency to want to develop a secular interpretation of Islam and unite the people behind these rulers under the banner of nationalism and development, by which was meant industrial sudden crash development. And these rulers ended up being the people who were most in contact with the Western colonizing imperialist forces in their own countries. That's inevitable because that's who, you know, had the interaction. They met each other. And they adopted the clothing and the lifestyle, and they became very Westernized. And the democratic apparatus was not in place to enable. When money came pouring in for these guys from the West, for that to somehow filter down to most of the people, and also for most of the people to have some kind of participation in the decision-making about what was going to happen with this money. The money that I'm talking about is, in some cases, oil money, but in some cases, it is foreign aid money that was dispensed during the Cold War by both sides as a sop to get these countries to lean either to this camp or to that camp. So the result was that a small elite class in many of these countries became rich and powerful and kept the money, and there was a gulf that developed between them and the people. And then, you know, amongst the people, the other schools of reformist ideas, which were very political, which were very militant, they were able to secure their roots. And in the 70s, all these secular modernist groups began to fall in Pakistan and Afghanistan, in Iran and in other places. So it's all mixed up with that.
Lady in the second row.
What is the history of the treatment of women, and what is the hope that it might change?
Well, you know, this is a complex issue that you bring up, and it's definitely true that that in many parts of the Muslim world, women have been subjected to abuses, and there's a definite problem to be solved there. There's two things I would say about that. One is, when you look at the situation of women in Islam as it was originally constituted in the first Muslim community, which is the founding experience of Islam, there's no question but that Islam was a progressive thing that happened to women at that time. And for example, when the Quran says, women, their testimony is acceptable in a dispute about certain things, but it has to be two women. One man's testimony is worth the testimony of two women. That sounds regressive, but actually, it was in the context of women's testimony was not allowed. It was like that was saying, got to have, women are allowed to testify. Their word is good for something. But now, the thing is, what was progressive then, if frozen at that place, becomes regressive later on. So now the question is not, the question is the process of interpretation that is applied to the historical experience of Muslims. If you say, the instructions of the Quran, when taken with the historical experience, should be interpreted as pointing to deep principles, and those are what we should be living by, then you might say the principle here is for greater equality between the genders. But if you are very literalist and say, well, whatever it says, that's how it is, and we got to just do that, then you have this situation of what was progressive then doesn't keep up, and things become aggressive. So there's that aspect of it, but there's also the fact that in the course of Muslim history, at a certain point, the sequestration and of women began, and that wasn't really the case in the first instance. And at some point, they were ousted from public life. Although in the first community, it seems pretty obvious that they were very much a part of they could go to meetings, they spoke, they were scholars, they had students, all of these things. Later on, they were sequestered and their position changed. I believe, but I don't have proof because I don't think, and maybe there's someone that's done this scholarship, but I don't know of it. And I think it would be difficult to do because they didn't write about it at the time, I think. But anyway, I think it happened during that same time that the world was falling apart and there was the invasions and the world turned conservative in many ways, the Muslim world, and that was part of that. But now some of what's happening today is a whole other question. And for example, there are patriarchal aspects of the tribal culture
along the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the pressures of the breakdown of that society have exacerbated patterns there that maybe worked in some sense in a village, in a stable village world that was then bombed by the Soviets and people went running off and became refugees everywhere. And I think that those conditions have produced new and monstrous results. And what I feel is that the way to deal with that from the point of view of an outsider is not to go in and say, okay, this is, we're going to make you change this aspect of your culture. It is to re-stabilize and get a culture feeling that it has control of its own destiny. And I will only say this in defense of my idea, which is that I grew up in Afghanistan when no woman except for my mother went out of the house without a chaudhari on. Chaudhari is that body bag veil. But in Afghanistan, no outsider came and said, anything. Afghanistan had its problems in that period in terms of the monarchy was authoritarian and stuff, but it was a stable, peaceful society. And they've abolished the veil, not by outlawing it. The royal family called the scholars in and said, we want to do the Islamic thing. And we're concerned because we haven't been able to find the part of the Quran that says women have to wear these things. Could you show that to us? Because you just want to make sure. And then the scholars couldn't find it. And then the royal family said, well, we're going to not have our women do that then in public. We're going to have them just dress modestly but not wear that veil. Well, that was in 59. And so from 1960 to 1975 or so, 15 years, maybe 80, 20 years, whatever. Afghanistan, the women of Afghanistan in the cities went through 2,000 years of social change in 20 years. And Afghans did that on their own for their own reasons. So it can happen in a Muslim society as conservative as Afghanistan. So I think peace is the first step.
I hate to say this, but we have time for one more question. So let me just, the gentleman at the back. The first row there, right there. Yeah, you.
Tamin, yeah. Your personal history is such a strong thread through all of your work. And if I can take us back, about 40 years in hope of that personal aspect can be a little bit of a window to the larger questions involved to Reed College, and both of us were at Reed College at the same time.
Really?
And we, for many of us, I mean, it's part of the tumult and the revelation of the time. And I must say, if there was ever a place where Western culture was enforced by strongest dictum, that would be Reed College. And for so many of us, that was our first experience of betrayal and outrage at what we were being fed, that we weren't being told the whole story.
Yeah.
And I remember that you were there, and I wonder, how did this affect him? And I'm just wondering if perhaps some of that dialectic is something that you can expand on a bit in terms of just the larger questions that we're looking at here.
Well, first of all, after we're done, you better come up here and tell me who you are, because after all these years, maybe I knew you then, but I don't recognize you. At Reed College and for the few years after, I went through a period when I thought I was part of a communal experience that was going to create a new world. And that it was going to be an ideal world. And in that period, I thought civilization was on its way to collapsing, and that we, counterculture people, were going to just start building the new one. You speak of betrayal. I remember at Reed, we were betrayed by the society, by the lies about Vietnam, by all things of this nature. The racial justice was not in place, and America wasn't living up to its ideals. And my experience of the counterculture finally was You know, we weren't living up to our ideals. We couldn't do it. We were failures. And by 1976, we all dispersed and went off to some of us to give up and become lawyers. And and some of us, you know, we got into life trouble. And anyway, we all went different places, and the whole thing seemed to die. Somebody recently, I said something like this, and somebody said to me, you're wrong. And then he started to list all the things in the culture that existed now because of that 60s experience that we had. And he was right. There's so much that's invisibly just become part of our world now. We take it for granted. We don't really think about, so much that I had something to do with bringing all that in. I'll tell you one thing, though. My own personal experience of being in the 60s that way and feeling, you know, just I really felt, I had mystical feelings about this stuff. And I don't mean supernatural or anything like that. I just felt like it was bigger than me, and it was happening anyhow, and I was like the train was leaving and I wanted to be on it. And I feel like that experience was but a thousand times more intense what the Muslims had in that early period when Prophet Muhammad built the community, and they thought that this was, you know, this was going to be, the world would be renewed. And even though many things of the 60s are permeated into the culture, the experience we had has not survived as a myth. I think largely people kind of ridicule that now, and they don't feel like, oh, if only I could have been there. But the Muslim experience in the Islamic world, it still resonates, 1,400 years later. So only from that can I imagine, wow, that must have been really something.
Thank you. Before I thank Tamim and ask, and thank you all, just a shameless plug for the LA Library Foundation that funds all this. We'll be out in the front in a few minutes, and your purchase of Tamim's book, Destiny Disrupted, the proceeds for that go to the foundation. There'll be a donation jar there, so I'd certainly encourage you, especially in these times, to support the Library Foundation. But let me thank all of you for being here, and thank Tamim for the wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.